Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Return of the Unexplained. Well, as I record here now, the rain is pounding on my window again, really heavily. But a funny thing has happened, and it's happened before when I've been recording these podcasts with you. As soon as I start speaking, and I talk about the rain, the sun begins to appear. Now, maybe that's something to do with you and me. Are we in... Sounds silly. Are we influencing the weather? Probably not, but who knows? We could do a whole show about that. Thank you very much for all of your recent emails, by the way. Always gratefully received. When you get in touch through the website, theunexplained.tv, please tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use this show. Love to hear from you. And you've said some very nice things recently. If your email requires a personal response, then it gets one in due course, as they say. And if you'd like to make a donation to the show, by the way, if you have made a donation recently, thank you very much. You can do that through the website too. TheUnexplained.tv, designed and created by Adam Cornwell from Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. This is going to be a special show. We feature again an old friend of this show and somebody who is a particular favourite of mine on the show, Kathleen Marden, the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, somebody who's had experiences of an alien kind herself. Somebody who's helped and knows many people who are contactees, abductees, and is very heavily involved, and somebody who puts a very, very credible case very cogently, and is also a nice person to speak with. So Kathleen Marden on this edition of the show for a specific reason. There was a story in our press here, and I'm going to quote from a story that ran in the Daily Star newspaper here, but I think it ran in others as well. Here's the quote. The man behind a world-famous alien abduction claims to have remembered three other terrifying encounters with a faceless woman after being hypnotized. Calvin Parker sparked a global media frenzy in 1973, October of that year, after he and his pal Charles Hickson told a sheriff that they'd been kidnapped by a UFO. The pair had been fishing in Pascagoula River, Mississippi, when they said they saw lights across the water before they were floated into a spacecraft. The full story of that, of course, you'll hear on a previous edition of this podcast, and is also in two great books from Philip Mantle's Flying Disc Press. Philip Mantle, again, great friend of this show. Glad to see those books are doing well. Calvin Parker, another very credible man. I found him to put a very appealing case together. Now, with the help of Kathleen Marden and hypnosis, as you will hear, Calvin Parker has revealed some new details, not only about the 1973 events, but also about events before that, and events, crucially, after that in the 1990s. So some new things that you will hear on this edition, and I think you will find them as compelling as I will find them. Please let me know. Go to the website and tell me. But let's not waste any more time. Let's get straight to Kathleen Marden. The way that this will work is that I'm going to use about 15 minutes of this on the radio show, and the rest of it, full-hour conversation, right here at theunexplained.tv on my podcast, which you and I have been doing together, and thank you for your help for 13 years now. So let's get to Kathleen Marden in the US, and my first question for her in this conversation was, did she approach Calvin Parker this time, or did Calvin Parker approach her?
I have to say that he did. I was speaking at a conference in Phoenix, Arizona, and he was also a speaker there. He approached me on the last night and asked me if I would be willing to hypnotize him. And arrangements had been made for me to fly into Mississippi and to do the hypnosis. So I was happy to do that.
And we know the Calvin Parker story. I've interviewed Calvin Parker on my podcast. I find him very credible. I find him very sincere. I also find him a man who didn't really want to talk 40-odd years on about this anymore, but he felt he needed to. Why did he tell you that he wanted to do this now?
There were questions regarding his experiences. He had been hypnotized by Bud Hopkins in the past, and several experiences had sort of run into one. So there were a lot of questions that needed to be answered, and this is why I was called in to do another hypnosis session with Calvin.
And you say a lot of questions to be answered. Are they the kinds of things that affect people who say that they've been abducted? And that is the nightmares, the sense of trauma, the general fear, the sense that something is not quite resolved. 40 years on, is that how he was feeling?
Well, I suspect that he does still, or was still, holding some trauma in his body. But there were many other questions, such as what was it that he saw when he was a little boy in his home looking out his bedroom window one night? What did he see when he was out camping when he was a boy with Charlie Hickson? What happened in an experience that occurred in 1993? And under the hypnosis that he had with Bud Hopkins, it sort of all ran into one with no separation of the dates or the times.
And of course, it's crucial to separate those things because they show, in most cases, they tend to show a progression, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Okay. And are you sure that at this length of time, any recollections that you drag up, you bring up from him are accurate? Or could they be affected by things that he's read and seen and experienced since?
Well, certainly there is the risk of confabulation when anyone does hypnosis. But with Calvin, I used what was called a forensic technique. And it is a technique that reduces the possibility of confabulation. So I did the best that I could. This technique formally was permissible as evidence in a court of law until it was brought into question. I believe it was in the 1980s or 90s when there were a group that called themselves false memory syndrome researchers. And as a result of their questions, it was no longer permissible in a court of law. But it is the best technique available, in my opinion.
And when you met Calvin Parker, how did he seem to you? Did he seem to be a man who wanted to just get this out of the way because he was sick of hearing about it? Or does he now seem to be somebody who wants to genuinely probe this? So before he inevitably, like all of us, shuffles off this mortal coil, he'll get the answers that he needs.
I knew that that Calvin trusted me implicitly, that he felt comfortable with me, and that he wanted to probe further into his experiences.
Okay, well, I think we need to get into those. Shall we start then with what came out about his childhood experiences that we perhaps haven't heard before?
Yes, absolutely. Calvin remembered an event that he had when he was 9 years old, and he was in his bedroom at night. His brother and his mother were there as well, and they were looking out the window at a snake that was eating a frog, because we're in Mississippi and that kind of thing happens.
It's a day-to-day occurrence.
They lived on a farm, so next to the house was the barbed wire fence for the cow pasture. And as he was looking out the window, he saw a woman walking by that was highly unusual. Nobody ever walked by there. She was extremely thin, sort of pencil thin, and she was wearing blue, dressed in blue slacks, a blue top, and she had a blue kerchief fastened around her head. And when she looked at him, he could see right through where her face would have been to the point at the back of the kerchief on the back of her head. And so this was very, very perplexing. Under hypnosis, we could not find a face on that woman. So what it tells me is that she was partially materialized. And so the question is this a ghost? Is this an extraterrestrial in the process of materializing? What is going on here?
Or is it possible that Calvin Parker had blocked out the details of the face?
I don't think so, because he did see the face clearly at other times during his regression.
Okay. So that's the early experience.
That is the earliest experience when he was 9 years old, yes.
And then came the main event much later.
Well, there was another experience when he was a child, too.
Okay, what about that?
And he was on a camping trip with his brother, his father, Charlie Hickson, Charlie's wife, and Charlie's children. And Calvin was sort of drawn to the woods that were along the bank of the Pearl River in Mississippi, a little bit of a distance from his childhood home. And they were camping out there overnight. There was a campfire. They were sleeping on the riverbank. And Calvin was drawn to the edge of the woods where he saw this very thin woman again. This time she had a face, and her face was very pleasant to look at. She had blonde hair. It was very short hair, and she was beckoning him to come into the woods. But just before he was ready to follow her into the woods, Charlie Hickson called him. It was dinner time. It was time for him to roast his hot dog on a stick over the campfire. And so, being an obedient child, he went back to the group and didn't go into the woods.
And of course, you know, being very driven like most boys are by hot dogs, you know, I think probably at that age I'd have made that choice too. So there was another experience. Did this person, this creature, this alien, whatever she may have been, communicate with him beyond beckoning?
No, she didn't communicate with him beyond that at that time.
And did he get a sense that there was some connection between her and him?
He did feel that there was some kind of connection, that she had been visible in his life when he was 9 years old. He was certain that it was the same woman. And I pushed. I wanted to know, did anything happen that night? Because we know that, you know, Charlie Hickson experienced contact along with Calvin in 1973, and there was no memory. And I had given the suggestion that if this occurred, you will remember it now. And I even used suggestions to strengthen his memory. But still, there was no memory of having this occurred during the night.
That's interesting. So, you know, how did he consciously, how did he rationalize these things?
He didn't know what to think of this. Is it interdimensional? Is this a non-human entity, an extraterrestrial that has visited him time and time again? What is this? And so that was one of the reasons why we probed into these experiences that he had had. You know, we know that there were witnesses to this woman, not to the woman herself, but to the craft in 1973, when he and Charlie were taken from the shore of the river in Pascagoula.
And indeed, new witnesses, even after all this length of time, with the help of Philip Mantle, you know, there are new people.
Yes, there are. So we know that something did happen. This was not a figment of Calvin's imagination. But there were many questions as well.
So those early experiences, how would you encapsulate what you learned through hypnosis and what he learned through hypnosis?
In the early experiences, I would say that this was real, that his brother awakened during the night when he was 9 years old, during that experience, and thought that there was a ghost blowing into Calvin's ear. Calvin had a wet ear, and so we probed this under hypnosis, and what actually did happen. What we discovered is that if something did happen that night, Calvin was sleeping. He remained sleeping, and he could not remember anything beyond this. in my opinion, I would guess that something did happen that night, particularly since he saw that woman. I used all of my techniques to unblock anything that might be hidden, that might be repressed, but still it was not brought forward. I do know that sometimes people are rendered unconscious, that they are asleep during the entire experience. So that is possible.
And that would indicate, as we've heard with other cases, haven't we, a pattern of ongoing contact, a pattern of ongoing occurrences, not just one or two, but something that starts early in childhood and continues through life. It might take a break and then it'll repeat itself in the teens, and the experiences will become more intense. It's presumptuous for me to say so, but Calvin Parker is starting to exhibit some classic signs here, isn't he?
Yes, he is very much exhibiting the signs of a generational experiencer. I had the opportunity to speak with Calvin's mother, too, who did see a craft that came in and hovered on the backlands of her farm, and she was indeed very frightened. All of the cattle had run up to the front of the pasture near the home and into the area where the barn was. So, you know, there does appear to be a connection between the place where Calvin grew up and these experiences.
And what about Charlie Hickson? Because he shows up in the early experiences and also shows up in the main event in 1973. Is there a sense that they're interested, I say they, whatever, you know, made this happen, are interested in him too, or is he just an incidental part of the story?
Well, that's impossible for me to determine. Many people think that Charlie just happened to be there and was taken that night. But there is the possibility that Charlie was part of this, too, and that his family was being taken and examined. And we know that Charlie had ongoing experiences. I have no reason to doubt that his experiences were ongoing after the 1973 abduction.
Charlie, of course, not with us any longer.
That is correct. He's deceased. So
it would be impossible to do anything like this with him. And indeed, he was even more reticent than Calvin to talk about this.
As time went on, you know, back in those times, there were some very nasty disinformants in the United States. And what they did is they created a false scenario in order to ridicule that individual who had been taken, in order to dissuade the public from believing that this did occur, to assault their character, their mental stability. They used a number of techniques that really cast doubt on all of the very good evidence cases.
And there are two ways to react to this, aren't there? One is to stick to your story and double down, and the other one is to just say, okay, I don't want to put up with this anymore. I'm just going to forget it.
Yes, that is true. And, you know, Charlie continued to speak out about what occurred to him. Calvin remained very, very quiet for many years.
Okay, to the main event itself then in 1973, the one that the book was about, the one that all of the coverage has been about over the years. What new did we learn about this? Because here we see this female alien, for want of a better word, appearing but not being quite so benign.
That's true. And what I attempted to do is to find out exactly what happened step by step. We know that Calvin and Charlie were out on the pier. He described it in great detail. They were seated on a log. They were fishing. Calvin saw this light in the sky, and this light was coming in closer and closer, and then suddenly he no longer saw it, but he became aware of a light that was behind him, and it was an extremely intense light. He looked back, but it was so bright that he wasn't even able to see anything in detail. And out of this light floated these non-human entities that had very long arms, a very large upper chest, but a face that was very small, a head that was extremely small and almost featureless in a sense. He wasn't able to see anything. And they just came and they took hold of Charlie. They took hold of Calvin and floated them onto this craft that was either hovering above the ground or had landed. You know, it was so bright that there were not a lot of details. And that is something that I think is very important, because Calvin didn't confabulate there. He saw only what he saw. And he had the courage to say, "It's just too bright. I can't see more." And that's really important. Because some people, particularly when there is a person that they respect, who they believe in, is a position of authority.
They'll want to please you.
They would want to please, and they would confabulate. But he did not confabulate. And that is extremely important.
That sounds to me like a very good sign. Because as you say, somebody who wants to please, somebody wants to come up with the goods, if there are goods to be come up with, then they'll start to say, "And you know, I'm pretty sure that you know, there was this there, and I think I saw something on the wall, and you know, maybe those things weren't there at all." So as far as you're aware, he stuck to the facts of the experience.
He did speak to the facts of the experience.
And the experience was, and you got more detail out of him about the experience in the main event abduction, was not pleasant at all. I mean, this was traumatic, big time.
Oh, absolutely. It was very traumatic. And it is something that would have to be worked out with an individual who believes that this is possible, and who will help this individual to overcome any of this fear that they might be experiencing. He was able to see that this woman had brown eyes and very long fingers on her hand, but he said that he was able to see five fingers. But no, he didn't notice fingernails. If she had them, he simply didn't notice them. So again, he is not confabulating. He's not saying she has her fingernails when she doesn't. He's simply saying, "No, I didn't notice that, if she had them or not."
And you use the designation "she." Is that because he sensed that this was a she, or because in our terms she had some of the characteristics of a woman?
He said that she was very thin, that she had the characteristics of a woman, but she looked undernourished. She had a nose, eyes, mouth. Her lips were thin. She had ears. And he didn't notice any clothing, if she had any on, in this particular event.
And did he get a sense that this woman was related to him in some way?
He didn't get that sense after the experience and after the hypnosis session was over. Later that afternoon, we were entering into a conversation and maybe speculating about what this could have been. And I said, "Well, could this possibly have maybe been one of your relatives coming back?" And he said, "Well, I hope not, because I tried to kill her." So,
and how did he do? I mean, I know that he had a struggle, because he talked about that with me. Were you able to discern any more about how he attempted to extricate himself from this in 1973?
Well, the struggle was not in 1973. It was in 1993, in a different event. In 1973, he was pretty docile. He noticed that her fingers were wrong. She was rubbing his cheek. There was a blue device that came down over his head. His mouth was open. She was trying to put something into down his throat, and he was choking. But there was not an altercation in 1973.
But clearly this was not a pleasant experience for him, and it was something that he resisted as far as you could resist.
Yes, you know, nobody likes to have anything inserted down their throat. I suspect that what happened was that she was inserting an implant. And that is his memory of what occurred. I asked the question, is it her fingers that are going down your throat? Do you see her hand? He said, well, I can see her hand. I don't know if he was holding anything or not. But I do know from being a researcher and from being a hypnotherapist and a quantum healing hypnosis technique practitioner that implants are inserted. And this was something that was being inserted, and that his nose was bleeding a lot.
And in fact, doesn't the story go that when he got back down to Earth, that his nose was bleeding then?
Yes.
So yes. That's a bit of corroboration, it seems. But was there any other sign by the time he got back down of what had happened to him?
No, there wasn't a great deal of memory when he was returned, except for on the evidence that was on his car. The window on the passenger side was shattered, completely shattered into little pieces. Charlie had a whiskey bottle, and that was under the front seat on the passenger side. It too was broken, and there was a long scratch line down the side, the same side. And this was a new car to Calvin, so that was pretty unfortunate that suddenly there was all of this damage. And, you know, the feeling that Calvin had was he just wanted to get out of there. You know, he went to work the next day, and then he was taken to an Air Force base for testing. But after that, he just got into his car, and he went home. He wanted the comfort of his own family, which is perfectly understandable.
When he was actually up there, and when he was with the woman, and when he was going through the experience, was he able to pull out any more detail about what the craft was like, about anybody else he may have seen there, about any sense of where he was relative to where he'd been? You know, in other words, where this thing was relative to where he was snatched from?
The interior of the craft was already covered, I believe, by Bud Hopkins. So I didn't ask for a lot of details about the interior. I had only 2 hours in which to complete all of this hypnosis session, all of these questions, and I had four different sessions or four different events to obtain information about. So I didn't repeat many of the questions that Bud Hopkins had asked. I only probed further beyond the probing that Bud had done. So Bud had gotten a lot of information about the craft itself, and I didn't want to waste a lot of time and not get the information that we were looking for in this hypnosis session. It's not a good idea to go beyond 2 hours, because then the individual becomes extremely tired, and you don't want to do that. A guideline for hypnosis is you don't do much more than 2 hours of questioning.
So you had to be very focused. In relation to the 1973 incident, what's the most important thing you believe that you learned?
I learned that what had happened to Calvin is that he was taken onto this craft by this non-human with a huge upper body and long arms and a tiny head who appeared to be robotic or bio-robotic, who floated above the ground, who grabbed Calvin and floated him onto this craft and then stood against the wall and did nothing, just remained there until signaled to do so by this woman, and that this woman then conducted what appeared to be a scan of his head and then did what appeared to be the insertion of an implant.
And were there signs of, remind me, were there signs of this implant when he came back to Earth?
He wasn't aware of this. You generally aren't.
And we have to remember the fact that people only really started talking about alien implants a long time after the 1973 incident. You know, it wasn't the kind of thing that you read about.
That is correct.
So it wasn't, I mean, these days people know about this stuff. People listening to this show will understand those things. They'll be aware of the work of people like Dr. Lear and others in that field. But back in those days, not so. It was all very embryonic. Okay, so you think that the 1973 recollections were useful and add to the story?
Absolutely. I think that we found some very important information, and we were able to separate that event from the event that occurred in 1990.
And that, again, is very important to be able to get a very clear timeline. Any new information from the 1973 incident before we leave that behind as to why they wanted him and what they wanted from him?
Information that I have that I haven't already mentioned will be in the transcript in Calvin's new book, and I don't want to give everyone all of the information and destroy the chances of the book being successful.
Oh, no, I understand. Give me a clue if you can.
Well, as I told you, I believe based upon my findings under hypnosis with Calvin, this is generational contact and that he was taken at least four times during his lifetime.
The 1993 incident. Now, this one was no picnic at all. And, you know, first of all, as you say, there was the belief that this was part of the 1973 incident. And now we know more that there was something in 1993, which by anybody's estimation was not nice, not at all.
That is very true. The 1993 incident was very traumatic. Calvin had just gone out on a fishing trip, and he was out there waiting for the tide to come in, and it was just about lunchtime, actually, and he started to eat a sandwich that didn't taste good to him. And the next thing he knew under hypnosis, he is being lifted into the air and finds himself again on this craft and in the presence of this woman again, very pale features. Her hair is now longer and she appears to have aged. So it causes me to believe that, you know, maybe she was not some kind of robotic or bio-robotic device. Maybe she was a sentient being.
And a creature perhaps deputed for reasons that we don't fully understand to follow him through his life.
Yes. Yes, that is correct. Mm. And so this time there was some trauma from him. And I was very, very careful because he has had some health conditions that, you know, I wanted to make sure he didn't have a heart attack or a stroke.
I was about to ask that, you know, Kathleen. I was about to say, I presume you were monitoring his vital signs through all of this, because if he's reliving the trauma under hypnosis, that can be very realistic.
Absolutely. I was seated so I could see his face. And if there was any indication that he was beginning to experience any kind of anxiety or trauma, I had him step back. I gave him suggestions. You will not feel it now. You're very relaxed. You're very calm. You can just watch this. You will not feel any pain. And this was extremely important for Calvin and for me as the hypnotherapist, sustaining his good health. That he has now, and not having him have a heart attack or a stroke, which was a concern.
But when he was encountering her, and when he was going through this in 1993, and indeed all of the instances that you talk about and you dealt with, you were able to see his heart rate increase as he was reliving these things? All of those things were happening?
Well, I didn't have a heart monitor on him. I use his body signals. He was covered over by a blanket to be very comfortable as he's going through this. And so I was looking at his face, the color of his face, his body language, if he was tightening up, that kind of thing.
Okay. And the 1993 incident, how would you summarize what more has been learned about that? Apart from the fact that you were able to get a little bit more detail and you were able to separate it firmly in time from what happened in 1973. Just give me the standout points.
Well, Calvin believed that this woman was attempting to murder him. To murder him. He was extremely distressed because she had sliced his hand open, and he still has a very long scar on his hand where this occurred. And blood was simply running what he thought was onto the floor. He was losing consciousness, and then he was going through the tunnel toward the light at the end of the tunnel when she suddenly pulled him back. And since he was believing that she was attempting to murder him, he was now able to fight back. He found that he was not paralyzed. He was not fastened to the table in any way. She had sort of, being very strong, lifted him up off the table and put him up against the wall, and his head was tipped back, and he was very terrified about what was going on, and there was blood all over his shirt. And
was he, when you said he felt that he was going towards the light, did he sense that he was dying at that point?
Yes, he did sense that he was dying.
So how was he able to fight back in that way if he was, you know, weakened?
Because she pulled him out of there. She pulled him out. Something happened. And this,
so she had second thoughts.
Maybe she wasn't really trying to kill him at all.
Maybe she was, for reasons, we can only speculate, but to take him to a place that's near what we call death. Maybe they, if there's another race observing us and checking us out, maybe they don't have that concept, and maybe they were interested in that. I mean, these are all maybe questions, aren't they?
Yes, it's all speculation. We can speculate about many things, including his soul, his consciousness, what was going on with her in this situation.
And did he get a sense then, if there was this struggle, this almost epic struggle, for him to come back to life and to be brought back to life, that something else beyond all of them intervened here? Was there a sense of something bigger?
I don't know. I do believe that there was a sense of something bigger taking place with this near-death experience that Calvin had during this. At least that was his perception of what was occurring.
Was he able to say what I would say? What the hell are you doing, and why the hell are you doing this?
Well, he didn't ask her that. What he did is he fought back because he was able to move. He wanted to grab a hold of her, and he wanted to leave that room, and he wanted to jump off that craft with her, and he didn't care if it killed him too. That was his plan. But there were no openings on the wall. Everything was perfectly smooth. She grabbed a hold of him. She took him. She stood him against the wall and tipped his head back. And when that happened, he grabbed her by the neck and he strangled her. And when he did this, blood started to come out of her ears and out of her mouth. And when that happened, it was not red blood. It was black in color. And she finally tipped her head back and she let out a cry that sounded like the cry of an alligator when it had a mating call. That was the closest thing that he could compare this to. And when she did this, that entity who always stands against the wall, who has a very large upper body and arms and that tiny head, came to her rescue and stopped what was happening. Calvin, it grabbed a hold of Calvin, and something happened. There was almost like an electric shock to his arm, and then he became docile again.
So how did he free himself finally? How did he get himself back to our plane?
The next thing he knew, he was on his boat. It was now dark. Remember, it had been about 11:30 in the morning, maybe noon, in what seemed like a moment before. So we know that he was gone for many Earth hours. But time is different where she was. And so that's something that we cannot reconcile. Was he unconscious for many hours? Was this short in Earth hours, I mean, in their hours, but long in Earth hours? So, you know, more questions. Mm. We don't know the answers because it's so speculative. We don't have all of the answers to what these non-human entities from a different dimension or maybe from a different planet somewhere in our galaxy are doing. What were they doing with Calvin all of these times during his lifetime? There are so many questions that we really can't answer at this time because they certainly didn't give him the answers to those questions, and we don't have the answers. Nobody does.
This is a really dumb question potentially, but I'll ask it anyway. If I was Calvin and I'd been through what I'd been through in 1973, I probably would have made a habit of keeping away from isolated places, maybe going on boat trips, being in places where there weren't many other people, just in case something like that happened again. But he didn't do that.
No, he didn't. You know, I think that Calvin probably thought that it happened only once, and that was in 1973. And he had these questions about this woman that he saw when he was 9 and again when he was 12. But, you know, there wasn't much memory with regard to that. So he might have thought, well, this woman was a ghost and didn't really put it all together immediately. That's a question that I have.
From your perspective as the person who did the hypnosis this time, do you get the impression that Calvin's story, as I think we're hearing anyway, is a patchwork that has yet to fully unfold?
I think that perhaps more could unfold if there were more hypnosis sessions, if I were to do more sessions with him. And Calvin and his wife have made the decision that Calvin will not have any more hypnosis.
And do you, I understand that? Do you?
Yes, I do.
Mm. Although, obviously, for obvious reasons, as a researcher, I guess you wish that one of these days he might wake up and say, okay, one more time.
You know, maybe, but that's up to Calvin. You know, every time that anyone undergoes this kind of hypnosis experience where they're back there reliving it again and new memories come forward, there's always some traumatic memories that come back as well. Using the quantum healing hypnosis technique, I made an attempt, and I think that it was a good attempt, to help him to overcome any trauma that he had. He was also shown a very grim future. And I can understand why he wouldn't want to visit that future through hypnosis again.
You mean a very grim future for us generally, or for him?
For us on this planet.
And what's in that future?
Perhaps a nuclear holocaust.
I wonder why they would want him to know that.
You know, they've been telling experiencers that time and time again, dating back to the mid-1950s. They're very, very concerned about our use of nuclear weapons. We don't know if this was just shown to him as something that might have occurred on their planet or in our past, or if this is indeed something from the future. She did not give him the information about whether this was the past or the future. But it was dreadful for him to experience and took a lot of calming and telling him to just relax, be calm, that nothing would bother him, nothing would bother him, nothing would bother him. You know, and that is very, very important when you're working with somebody. You don't want that memory, that traumatic memory, to follow them through their conscious recall.
This clearly made an impression on you, and we have to remind people who might be new to this that you've lived your life, not in the shadow, but as part of all of this, because you are the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, the most famous, probably, alien abductees of all time. You know, the grandmother and grandfather of it all, really, back in the early 1960s. You know, you were there with them throughout all of this. Talking to Calvin, do you see any similarities?
I can see the similarity in the abduction scenario itself, in being taken to a room, being put on a table, having procedures performed, but it appears that these were different non-human entities, not the same entities that Betty and Barney and my family experienced.
And how are you feeling about, I mean, this is 2019, it's the back end of 2019, it's been a while since we've spoken. How are you feeling now about all of that?
About Betty and Barney's experience?
I mean, you know, all of us, time is marching on for us all. As you get to the stage in your life that you're at, do you feel that you've done as much for their legacy as you're going to be able to do now?
I have expanded their legacy. And I have recently come forward for the first time to state that this was generational, that my mother and I were also taken, that this was investigated back in the time frame when we were taken by a very prominent researcher in the United States, and that we made the decision that it would remain confidential throughout our lifetimes, so that no one would ever know this until after I died. But I made the decision more recently to come forward because I wanted to help others to understand this. I now believe that Betty's and Barney's abductors, or those who took them, came back time and time again in Betty's life, and that they were not horrible, They were not trying to kill Betty or Barney or anything like Calvin experienced. Calvin's experience was negative. Betty's and Barney's experience was not negative, although it was very frightening to Barney initially. They were reassured time and time again that no harm would come to them, that these entities cared about them. And also for my mother and I, that no harm would come to us, that they were only trying to help us and to help humanity. And I've written about some of my own contact events in my new book, Extraterrestrial Contact, What to Do When You've Been Abducted, that was recently released.
And you don't sound, if you had this experience too, then you don't sound at all traumatized by it.
I was initially. It took years of working through this because, and I think that the reason for the trauma was that it was expected that some of these early researchers were focusing upon the fear. They were focusing upon trauma, and they were focusing on the idea that anyone who is having these experiences is having something very horrible happening to them against their will. I believe that it's time to take a different look at this. We know that some of this is positive and that some of this is negative, depending upon the type of entity. I've worked on three studies on experiencers, the first with 50 experiencers and a 25-person control group, the second on 4,000 experiences, and on the third with 516 experiences. With a psychological measure that was also used by a social scientist, Dr. Don C. Donderi, we have been able to separate this out and be able to understand exactly what is occurring, what experiencers' attitudes are toward all of this. And we asked the question, if you could make this stop today, would you?
And?
75% of the abductees said no, they would not want it to stop. It was 71% of the experiencers in general.
Isn't that interesting? Is that because they feel they're learning?
Yes, they are learning, they're receiving information, and they have received gifts, the gift of psychic ability, the gift of being empathic, the gift of having knowledge that they didn't formally possess, the gift of having a different sense of purpose on this planet. And so it is viewed as being gifts that were given to them.
Well, a fascinating conversation, Kathleen. Thank you very much for that. One final thing to ask, and it's just, you know, it's occurred to me all the way through this conversation. I feel, and I'm sure you will feel too, that there are bound to be people who've had these experiences themselves, many of them probably, who simply haven't felt enabled to be able to come forward and tell their story and perhaps get help if they need it. What would you recommend them to do?
Well, my new book, Extraterrestrial Contact, What to Do When You've Been Abducted, is a handbook for people who have these experiences and have these questions. You can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, from bookstores, and it's a guide that was written by myself and four members, three other members of my team at the Mutual UFO Network. It has everything you need to learn about how to investigate your case, understanding modern contact, the type of experience that you are having, if you discover it is your reality, what to do next, the stages that you go through. It has information on the social research that has been done, the paranormal overlay, how to cope with this, and how to make it stop. If you wanted to stop, suggestions on resistance techniques.
Resistance
techniques.
And if
you want to go public, what can you do?
Okay, well, resistance techniques as well. We have a whole other conversation to do about that, I think. But for those people, you know, before they buy the book, who should they reach out to first? Who should you tell?
I would say tell someone you trust. Find someone who has had the same type of experience. I can tell you that the Mutual UFO Network has the Experiencer Research Team. And I believe that we have a member in the UK. You can go to MUFON.com, scroll down to the Experiencer Research Team, click on Speak with a member of the Experiencer Research Team to share your story. That will take you to the Experiencer Research Team page, and at the top of the page is the Experiencer Questionnaire. It's only 30 true and false or yes and no questions. Complete that. It will go to my assistant director, Dr. George Medich, and he will assign a member of the Experiencer Research Team, a specialist. And all of these people listen non-judgmentally. They are there just to listen and help. If anyone in the UK is interested in hypnosis or a support group, they have that information as well. So this is what I recommend, that you go to, that you purchase this book, and that you go to MUFON's Experiencer Research Team to seek out help from a member of the team.
Kathleen, good to talk with you again.
It's very nice to talk to you as well.
Well, what do you make of that? Kathleen Marden, always welcome on this show, and some new information from and about Calvin Parker, and not only the Pascagoula incident, but other connected related incidents. I find it very compelling and very, very interesting. Your thoughts welcome, of course. Go to my website, theunexplained.tv, and let me know. And while you're at it, if you'd like to visit my new Facebook page, The Unexplained with Howard Hughes, please do. Be part of that. We're trying to build that. This is an independent show, of course, as you know, and it runs on donations, as it has for years, and it depends on your involvement. And thank you very much for all of the things that you've done for me over the years. You know, I am committed to doing this as long as there's breath in me. So thank you. More great guests in the pipeline as we head towards the end of 2019. So until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained. And please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.